body, echoing an unbearable bomb. Then, everything went silent, and she remembered the peace of the desert on Naufruma, and how you could see every star when you looked up into the nighttime sky. The quietest place in the world, Julian had said. Julian, things were good then. The entire world in that moment had funneled down to two things: darkness and his voice. Then the blackness parted, and she saw glimmers of light, heard that same voice, only it was screaming. Someone flew at Yendit. A man? No, not a man. The fisherman.
I've arrived, he boomed as he socked Yendit in the face again and again. His harpoon gun was strapped to his side, but he didn't need it. Yendit's face was already pulpy, wet with dark blood. Ree rolled over and saw Yendit catch the fisherman and choke him, pinning him against the wall with both hands. Ree got to her knees, unable to pull herself up on her weak foot, her breath still tight and hard in her chest. The fisherman wedged his hands between Yendit's arms and stuck his thumbs into his eyes so that the man screamed. But if he eased up on the hold, Ree couldn't tell. Keeping as low to the ground as possible, Ree crawled toward them. Julian and Lana were still struggling with their respective guards, but Ree wanted to help. There were yells from the slaughter, though they were alarmingly quiet, already expiring. The Tassin had done enough. The place was awash in the smell of death, the feel of it, like a weight in the air, making it hard to breathe. She reached Julian's knife that had landed on the floor. The chamber floor, she saw, was flooded with blood. Julian grabbed her. Ree realized the Tassin he had fought was on the floor, and only Lana's guard was left, pinning her to the ground. Julian took the knife out of Ree's hand, and Ree could barely protest, unable to find her voice. Julian held it with such ease, as if it had been part of his hand all along. She saw Julian's eyes meet the girl's and fought the urge to look away as he pulled the knife back and brought it down hard on the back of the guard's neck. No hesitation. No alloy reinforcements there. He slumped forward, transforming in a split second to a corpse. Lana scrambled up with a quick thanks, then kneeled to pull the knife out of the guard's neck. Blood poured out. Lana wiped the blade clean on her tunic. Meanwhile, Yendit had stopped struggling, while the fisherman berated his unconscious body and yelled what seemed to be a string of curses, possibly in multiple languages, none of which Ree recognized. Jeth limped up next to them. He was in rough shape, but still standing. And with the robo-soldier's comm unit in his hand, he'd managed to disable it. "Who's this?" he said over the fisherman's curses. "I am the second most important person in the galaxy, as far as you lot are concerned," he called over his shoulder. "Because I'm supposed to keep this impossible brat of an empress alive!"
When the fisherman seemed satisfied that Yendit was dead, he let his body drop to the floor before spinning around to face them.
"Were you planning to tell the head of security that you were entering a literal bloodbath, then?"
he asked Ree as he heaved her up to her feet. Her foot ached viciously. "I'm sorry, there wasn't time."
"There wasn't time to call for your personal security detail?"
He threw his hands up in the air.
"Isn't she supposed to be clever?"
the fisherman asked of the three people at her side. He got up close to Ree and pointed a stubby finger in her face.
"You nearly died. If I hadn't followed you here, who knows—"
He didn't finish his sentence. The tip of the harpoon burst up through his chest. It would have stabbed Ree directly through the heart had Lana not pulled her away.
"No!"
The word nearly ripped her throat in two as Julian kicked in the side of Yendit's head. His neck tilted at an odd angle, and his body went limp again, falling in such a way that he cradled the harpoon gun to his chest. The fisherman's harpoon gun. The fisherman collapsed. Ree fell to her knees and grabbed the fisherman's hand.
"I'm so sorry,"
she repeated as his heavy-lidded eyes fluttered open.
"In the Outer Belt, we don't do sorries, Empress."
"I shouldn't have come here."
"Enough already on what you should or shouldn't have done." He paused to spit up blood.
I'm not a political man, but I'm a betting one. You're fierce and impossible, and you'll do all of us right on the Outer Belt, won't you?
Rhi nodded her head vigorously. He squeezed her hand in response.
Then I put all my credits on you.
Out of his elaborate belt that kept countless weapons, he produced a telescope, Julian's telescope, the very one she'd given him in exchange for his help on Tanopa.
Take it back. I've no use for it where I'm going.
Rhi took it, the metal cool in her palm, and watched him collapse, realizing how much effort it had taken him to sit up, to perform such a gesture of forgiveness and generosity. She dropped it into her pocket and burst into tears when the life left his eyes. Too many deaths. Too many deaths at her expense. Lana kneeled by her side and pressed her index fingers first to her eyes and then closed the fisherman's eyelids. Julian had closed his eyes, moving his mouth in what looked like a prayer. It was silent, save for the unconscious guards who stuttered and twitched in unison near them. She wondered if Nero was using some kind of server to infiltrate minds. They moved as if they couldn't talk or communicate when too much data streamed through them.
I know an exit, Jeff said. We should move.
And yet, Rhi was frozen, staring hard at the man who'd killed the fisherman. Behind her, the Tossen weren't done. They gutted the ambassadors one by one, trapped them against exits barred for this purpose, drilled them in their seats, spilled their guts out with a single swipe of their swords. But she drowned out the sound and went back to that moment on board Dalin's ship, floating on the outer edges of the Desuco Quadrant. How vast it had seemed, how insignificant Rhi had felt, and how she'd found peace in that. The fisherman had made his livelihood there. He'd fished out creatures who could survive without light and atmosphere, with nothing but a suit and an alloy harpoon gun. And yet, he would never find that solitude, that peace, again. Yendit had taken it away from him. She snatched the harpoon gun from Yendit's limp hands now. He was still alive. She could tell by the way his chest rose and fell. Taking aim, she pointed it at his chest.
Rhi?
Julian put his hand on her shoulder. Lana appeared on her other side, yet Rhi couldn't tear her eyes away from the murderer before her. There would be nothing noble about this kill, Lana said. He's unconscious. Rhi trembled, her index finger pressing down on the trigger, playing with the resistance of it.
Guys, we gotta move, Jeth said again. If we manage to get out of here alive, there are bigger fish to fry.
Her mind clouded over with thoughts of Nero. He was the bigger fish. And she had let him live. But she wouldn't make that same mistake again. Rhi lowered the harpoon gun. She'd face Yendit once more. She had a feeling. But Nero was the prize now. Part 4. The Crowned. In the long, illustrious rule of the Ta'an dynasty, what is often forgotten is their tumultuous ascent to power 12 generations prior, and the bloody attempt to keep it in the year 928. Excerpt from the Iron Star Updated Edition, A History of the Ta'an Dynasty. Chapter 23. Kara couldn't sleep in the chambers that once belonged to her parents. It should have been comforting. It should have felt like home. Instead, she felt encased in a deathbed. The room a shrine to the life she was supposed to have lived. For the past 2 days, ever since Nero had installed her back at the palace in Cebu, she had followed a woman through the dimly familiar rooms as though visiting a foreign land. or as though she were a ghost visiting a former life. And the guards had watched on. Given the many fine layers of her formal silk robes, and the elaborately arranged scarf that covered her hair, Kara figured the woman was a Tai. They were a sect of teachers and caretakers, Kara knew, and the woman gave off the proper air of someone who moved slowly and acted deliberately. She spoke in a monotone as she pointed out artifacts in the palace, a droning history lesson with no love or passion behind any of it. There was something familiar about her, as if Kara had known her before. And maybe she had. And maybe it was the case that she knew Rhiannon, too. But there was no way to ask her now. As was obvious from the glassiness of her eyes and eerie dreaminess of her movements, she was clearly under the influence of the Overrider. Kara silently thanked Diak for what felt like the millionth time for that Nero blocker. Her mind still felt clear. Nero might have the Overrider, but he'd not gotten inside her head, at least not yet. Still, everything about the palace felt foreign, and she craved to speak with someone who had their own thoughts and ideas, not a vessel for Nero's twisted game. Mostly, she mourned her sister. Rhiannon was dead. She had to be. In the last moments of their lives, the ambassadors of the United Planets had sent out frantic messages, begging for help. Empress Rhi was in trouble. They were all in trouble. The Tassin had turned. Dead. Dead. All of them dead. A horrific massacre. Nero's doing, obviously. He had used the Overrider to control the Tassin, turning them into a deadly army. And now Nero expected her to do a broadcast later that evening, one in which she pinned the massacre on Rhiannon. After all, the Tassin were her guards, and her body hadn't turned up among the corpses, or so he claimed. But Kara knew the truth. Rhi had been a casualty to Nero's ambition. She knew, too, that Nero was watching her through the guards that followed her, but not through her own cube, since she'd taken the neuroblocker. She had no idea how long its effects would last, though. She had no allies, no one to speak to. She was alone again. Issa had been taken as a prisoner down to the cellars, where she was heavily guarded. Kara needed to break her out and get as far away from the palace as possible. But then what? Would there be people on the outside whose cubes had been updated, who could be under Nero's influence at any moment? There had to be some sort of weak point in the palace security, a way to exit the walls without being seen. And there had to be holes in Nero's overall plan, contingencies that he went to great lengths to cover. If only she could read his mind, wrench open his thoughts and shuffle through them as casually as he had ingested the Overrider. A memory surfaced, rippling through her grief like a rock striking the water. And it wasn't at all the one she would have expected. She'd said much the same thing to Pavel back on Now Fruma, before Ali had left her, that she'd open up his head and rearrange him. What had Pavel told her in response? Something about cube-to-cube transfers. She couldn't get inside Nero's head, but maybe she could put Nero's head inside hers. Nero wouldn't let his cube die. And where else would he store it, if not in a host? Diak had told her the Overrider itself could be preserved in a living thing, a tree. The same could be said for the cube. As for Nero's cube, he had probably stored it in the very root system that had housed the Overrider. And her best bet was the palace greenhouse, though she had no idea where to find it. Listen, Kara told herself. Use your mind. She had no delusions she would get her memories back. Not when she needed them. And definitely not in the high-definition form of cube memories. But Kara thought, hoped, that there was some memory buried deep inside her muscles, inside her mind. Lydia had used the Overrider on her, and still she'd kept some things. Her sense of direction, her basic knowledge of how to do everyday things. If those were intact, maybe her body's memory of her former home was, too. Kara grabbed a paperweight from her father's desk a heavy model of Kalu, and stepped into the hall. It would make a clumsy weapon if she got caught. She would have to count on her memory to do the rest. Maybe if a guard stopped her, a clever lie. But the coast was eerily clear, as if the guards had suddenly been called away. She sent up a quick thank you to Vadhan, Ali's god, before she could push the urge away. Trying not to think of Ali, Kara moved through the shadows of the palace, her feet padded by the thick rugs, down one floor. She skirted the edges of the kitchen in case a guard passed. They didn't. Kara caught a glimpse of only one through the threshold as she crouched low and pressed herself against the counter. Then he disappeared down another hall, away from her, and she made her move. She slipped into a musty pantry with empty shelves and a broken light. There were no windows, but there was another door. She opened it. Here she was, damp, dark steps descending into a cellar. Kara paused, wondering when they would notice she was gone, or if they already knew. But did it matter? If there was any chance of stopping Nero, the time was now. Down in the cellars, she could sense the expanse of a whole world below that she would have explored when she was young. Kara stood in the dark and listened. There was a steady sound of quiet dripping. Comforting, if it weren't for the echo, or the dozens of palace guards ready to be deployed at Nero's behest to find her, to brainwash her, too, to strip away her humanity and her free will. That was not the way it would end. Kara would make her own choices. She listened. She knew there was a way out if she could just reason through it. What did she know about greenhouses? That they needed glass paneling for sunlight, insulation for the heat. It meant she would need to travel in the direction of the backyard to the south. What else? That there would be a water source. Plants needed water. The leak. She went toward it and found moss on the ground and walls that grew thicker the deeper she went in one direction. The deeper she moved in, away from the pantry, the darker it got. So black she couldn't see her own hands. She guided herself through the forks in the cellar by touch. It was wet and soft, and it reminded her of the moss that grew in patches in Luris, on slick stones deep in the forest, the further you moved from the shore. When the moss thinned out on the walls of the cellar, Kara backtracked. There wasn't much time, but she plunged forward, right, left, right, right, and then a quick left. There was light, and she felt a sliver of joy until she got scared again, wondering whether she'd only made a huge circle. But she found more light, and more, until she looked up and saw the outline of a door. Scrambling up the worn stairs, she cracked open the door and saw grass. To the left was the greenhouse. Kara was steps away from being outside. Outside, she flinched at the sunshine. So much horror had happened, she almost expected the world to have vanished. The garden path was overgrown now, crowded with untrimmed greenery. A memory burst into her mind then, or, if not a memory, an impression of one. The sweet smell of roses. Somewhere deep down, Kara had carried that with her. And even more, how the petals felt soft between her fingers, and the sadness she felt when they would eventually wilt and fall away with the slightest breeze. She knew it was some sort of organic memory, a remnant of her life before. And suddenly, she felt angry that they would only ever come back to her half-formed. The greenhouse rose up in the distance, a large glass building in the shape of a hexagon. Two guards paced the perimeter, and Kara hung back, ducking further into the shadows the massive greenery afforded, until they had disappeared around the corner. The coast was clear. She slipped into the open and darted to the greenhouse doors, praying she would find them open. Her heart did a weird little jig in her chest. The long silver handles felt cool to the touch, and they turned easily. Holding her breath, she passed inside. The air was humid. What from the outside had looked like a beautiful and well-tended greenhouse, on the inside was an expansive, riotous forest. The ceiling cut the light into prisms. The greenhouse was terraced, and hanging gardens rose up to the sky, sending leaves the size of her open palm cascading toward the ground. She'd been here before. She was sure of it. It occurred to her Nero had allowed this to thrive. He liked beautiful things when they were manicured and polished, stripped of their rawness. Though he might have planned to store the overrider here all along, and perhaps its more natural state was conducive to supporting it. She shuddered. Maybe he planned to grow it, as her mom had been growing it on Rheta. The paths through the towers of vertical planters were tight and winding, and her arms were soon coated in sweat and humidity and the clinging pollen of plant life. She wound her way toward the center of the greenhouse, where, beside a cluster of cherry blossom trees that threw their arms up to the sky, a lone gray stump was squatting in a heap of gravel and dirt. It looked like the cross-section of Rheta. It was a cross-section of Rheta. Kara dropped her weapon and plunged her hands into the dirt. The loose shale and gravel bit at her nails, and she knew it must be mixing with her blood. It felt fitting. She pawed down past the roots, scrabbling frantically now, all too aware that someone might arrive and surprise her at any second. Then, Kara felt it. A piece of metal that she pinched between her fingers. It was Nero's own cube, deep in the root system, thriving, living, waiting to be reclaimed. Pain coursed through her at the thought of having the cube implanted. What would it do to her? What would he do to her? It didn't matter. She had no choice. There had to be something there, in his cube, that could help her find a way to undo him for good. There had to be a way. If there wasn't, all was lost. She yanked the whole thing free. The cube was a dull piece of metal no bigger than her pinky finger, with exposed pink and white roots that, in the absence of something to nest into, began to wiggle as though alive. These, she knew, were the connective arteries that would join to her brain. She slipped the cube into the folds of her duhat, wiped her hands clean, and stood. Kara felt a shiver up her spine. The air pressure changed just slightly. She felt a draft that wasn't there before. Leaves rustled in the breeze. Kara froze. Someone had opened the door to the greenhouse. Kara sidestepped into the cherry branches and dropped into a crouch again. She heard heavy boots. A Tassin, it had to be, slowly drumming their way up the path. A droid was humming in the quiet, too. Likely a security model. It would tase her on sight. Closer. Closer. Almost on top of her now. Making a split-second decision, Kara hurtled into the open. She didn't get a good look at him. He was tall and in uniform, and that's all she had time to register. Then, all at once, she took off at a sprint and slammed into him, keeping her head down. As he spun backward, she ran past him toward the exit. Somewhere in front of her, an android was beeping repetitively. It didn't sound like a security bot, but she was hardly going to pivot to check it out. And she dodged down the path, careened through the narrow chasms of growth. She'd almost made it to the door when suddenly another guard stepped in front of her, flipping her neatly onto her back. She rolled over before he could drop on top of her, but he pinned her legs. She pushed and kicked, desperate to get free. It couldn't end here, with Nero's cube in her pocket, when she was so close to what she needed, and what the galaxy needed. "Kara," the guard said. And in a surreal moment, Kara thought she knew the voice. Then she realized she did know the voice. "Allie?" Chapter 24 Alyosha.
I thought you were dead, Allie said.
He still half thought he was dreaming. The greenhouse, the humidity, the landscape of growth. Kara standing in front of him, alive, as beautiful as ever.
I saw you die.
There was something more than the change in her eyes, her skin, her hair, the way she smelled. The essence of her had shifted. Yet hadn't changed in any vital way, shape, or form. It made it more obvious than ever. The
awful, aching truth that he loved her, and that he'd left her. "It wasn't me," she said.
Pavel rolled up slowly and pulled out a freshly cut rose from his chest compartment. "Did you know the rose variety found outside the palace is not a species indigenous to Kalu?" That got her to smile a little bit, the corners of her mouth quivering. Allie realized it was the kind of smile you forced your face to make. "Thanks, Pavel." She took it from the droid and put it to her nose absently.
"Please."
Allie reached for her hands. His palms were slick with sweat. All he wanted was for her to look at him, to understand he didn't know, that he did what he'd done for her. They were together now.
"Please, Kara, believe me. I swear, if I'd known, I never would have left Nowfruma. Ask Pavel."
"It doesn't matter now," she said. But at least she didn't pull away. Instead, she turned her eyes to Dalin. "Who are you?" she asked.
"Dalin," he said simply. "And you?"
Kara hesitated. "Kara," she said, at the exact same time Allie said,
"Princess Jocelyn."
"All of the above?" Pavel said. Dalin raised his eyebrows.
"Now that the introductions are concluded, perhaps we can save the rest of the joyful reunion for after we kill Nero."
"Not if you're navigating," Allie snapped back. "Pavel used your intel to track Nero to this exact spot. You said you had a line on Nero's cube." Kara looked from Allie to Dalin and back.
"You're here for Nero?"
"Isn't that what he just said?" Dalin said testily. "A real charmer."
Allie cut in before he could do any more damage.
"We're here to kill Nero. A few days ago, the WFC managed to tap Nero's cube location. After years and years of firewall, Nero must have lifted permissions, so we tracked him."
She looked between the two of them. "How many Tassin did you kill?"
9, Dalin said. "Everyone we found. We weren't able to remain undetected."
Kara stared at him. He didn't seem to notice.
"We tracked Nero here, to the greenhouse."
He looked around as if expecting the man to materialize. Kara took a deep breath. "You tracked his cube to this spot, because his cube is at this spot."
Now it was Allie's turn to stare.
"Nero has the Overrider," Kara said. "He had to swap out his cube for it. He'll know soon. He may already know."
"Know what?"
Allie said. He could hardly keep track of what she was saying. Kara shrugged, her mouth tilted up in that smirk she sometimes got when she figured something out before anyone else did. Thank Vadhan he recognized it, recognized something about her. But any relief he'd felt drained all the way out when she reached into her pocket, then held up her hand, opening it, and simply said, "That I stole it." Allie had to jog to keep pace with Kara as they moved freely through the palace. Dalin and Allie had cleared a path, and the Tassin, usually guarding the residential wing, were in Vadhan's hands now. Left, right, left. Allie lost track of all the dizzying twists and turns the palace concealed, even as he struggled to make sense of what she told them. The message that brought her to Ralier, the conversation with Diak while they were imprisoned, and how Nero had beat her to the Overrider. His heart seized when she told them about the massacre at the United Planets meeting.
"Does it not worry you that Rhiannon is gone?" Dalin asked.
Kara narrowed her eyes.
"Of course it worries me."
Then she turned, testing a door with her weight, and finding it open, hustling them down yet another flight of stairs.
"She could be gone," she said over her shoulder.
Her voice had cracked.
"Or she might have decided to run away."
"No."
Dalin's voice was surprisingly forceful.
"Not Re."
Allie raised an eyebrow at his use of her nickname. They had reached the subterranean level, dark and gloomy. It was filled with old furniture that had gone out of style during the Great War. The atmosphere was oppressive. Allie felt like he should tiptoe. Even Kara dropped her voice to a near whisper.
"Nero wants me to go on the air and denounce her, blame her for the council massacre. I can't."
She seemed to be looking for something.
She was glancing in different rooms as they passed, opening doors that led into unused vaults and the kind of barren quarters used to house servants or inmates of the throne.
Yes, you can, Allie said. A plan was taking shape in his mind. We can use Nero's tactics against him, undermine him on his own turf, where he feels safest.
How? Kara said. She threw open another door. She let out a sigh, as though disappointed to find it empty.
You do the broadcast, but we'll send Rhee a message to let her know you're here for her, Allie said. That you believe her, even if you're saying the opposite. Like hiding in plain sight.
But even if Rhiannon were to return, what then?
Dallan asked.
Then we get the two sisters together to denounce Nero. He'll have no choice but to return. He'll have to reassert control.
We get Kara and Rhiannon to a safe spot, and we kill him.
No,
Kara's voice was firm.
No?
He met her eyes. There was fire in them, the same light he'd seen when they first met.
I'm Empress now.
Allie's heart caught on the word Empress, as if he needed a reminder.
I can't run from it. Whatever plans I had, whatever it was I wanted, or thought I wanted, it doesn't matter.
Kara, he said. It sounded like she'd been going through some major tahis and hadn't had anyone to talk to say the least.
And besides, Kara said, cutting him off, Nero can't be killed.
No one can't be killed,
Dallan replied calmly.
Kara sighed. He's got the Overrider, which means he's connected to the minds of countless innocent people. And if he dies, all of their minds will be destroyed.
Destroyed? How do you know this? Allie asked.
He told me, Kara said defensively.
You can't believe a madman,
Dallan scoffed.
Nor can you accept his madness as sense.
But what if he was telling the truth? Allie demanded.
He felt suddenly sick to his stomach, remembering all the people he had ever disappointed, all the people he had abandoned. The folks in the Ray, the prisoners on Hul and now Fruma.
Kara.
All risks must be calculated. There is no greater threat than the existing one. Nero, with the Overrider.
Agreed, Kara said.
She tested another door. They found a room packed with barrels of honey wine. She backed out of it before Allie could suggest they take one for the road.
But if there's any truth to what he's saying, that thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people will die, I need some collateral against him.
I'm not following, Empress, Dallan said.
What are you proposing?
They were nearly at the end of the corridor. She whirled around suddenly to face him.
We have his cube.
She took a deep breath.
I need to upload it.
For a long second, they were all silent. Even Pavel could think of nothing to say.
That's nuts,
Allie choked out finally.
And dangerous. And why you? Any of us could do it.
Because he thinks I'm his pawn. I can get closer to him than any of you can.
I'm the one who's going to kill him. His cube is just my insurance.
Insurance? Dallan asked.
That he doesn't kill me first. If I die, his cube dies with me.
Maybe he'll kill me anyway, but it might make him hesitate. Give us the advantage. Pavel filled the heavy silence.
There's actually precedent in the cube-to-cube transfers, he said. And the way memories are willed down to family members before one's death.
Exactly,
Kara spun on her heel again. There were three doors yet untested in the hallway. Allie wondered what she was looking for, but he was too agitated to ask.
It's basically the same thing.
Or it's as different as night and day, Allie argued.
It's the difference between two living souls choosing to transfer memories between their cubes versus this.
Allie couldn't even come up with a word for it, but it felt wrong, like they were violating Vodhun's law itself.
You did it, Dallan pointed out.
That was a droid's comm unit,
Allie fired back. He had uploaded the droid's memories on Ustral, and even that had almost overwhelmed him, brought him to his knees.
Not a humanoid cube. Besides, I was in a medical facility.
Kara would need a very sophisticated medic, Pavel chimed in. It's likely she will have to have a portion of the hardware melded to her own cube.
I know someone who can do it. Kara tested the next door over. It swung open and she peered inside.
Allie looked over her shoulder to an empty room. She pushed her way past him and down the hall further.
You know someone qualified for complex cube surgery?
Not just complex, but illegal, according to the G1K Summit Accords, Pavel pointed out as he wheeled after Kara.
Right. Illegal, dangerous, and complex, Allie said, counting the improbables one by one on his fingers. You just got a guy that can do that?
Kara flung open the last door, revealing a Raten girl with braids to her waist that flung every which way as she came at them with a chair. Allie moved in front of Kara reflexively, shielding her with his arm. Dalin lunged forward to meet whatever feralness this girl was bringing, but Kara elbowed Allie out of the way and pulled on the back of Dalin's shirt with both her hands.
Stop!
She yelled, just as the girl registered the scene and dropped the chair. She put both her hands up, eyes wide as she took in the massive Fontizian who was about to rip her head off.
Took you long enough, she said.
It seemed like she was talking to Kara, but her eyes never left Dalin's.
Everyone, this is Issa.
Issa dropped her hands to her hips at the intro. Allie realized there was a medic patch across her uniform.
She's my guy.
Chapter 25. Rhiannon. After she'd killed Vayron, Rhi had claimed she knew plenty about death. She'd been ready to rush headlong into a haphazard plan to murder Siotra, the statesman she'd mistakenly blamed for Nero's plot. But Dalin had challenged her, questioning her in that condescending way that felt distinctly him.
Why? Because you've killed a man, he'd asked. That makes you just as qualified as most, which means not qualified at all.
Now she knew that he was right. Taking one life didn't give you intimate knowledge of death. Having her family taken from her didn't either, even if she felt their absence deep down in her bones, like there was nothing there, no blood or marrow, just the sorrow that burned off, evaporated, turned her into something toxic, so that for the longest time all she could feel was rage. There was only ever one thing to know. Death begets more death. The massacre of the United Planets Council just 3 days ago proved it beyond a doubt. Losing the fishermen had shaken her down to her core. The protests on the streets of Cebu had risen to new heights. All around the galaxy, riots were breaking out in otherwise neutral territories. Everyone had heard about the attack, and nobody could agree who was to blame. Only that someone had to pay. If Rhi was right, Nero would step up immediately to keep up appearances and do the work of acting appalled at the violence at the council meeting. Rhi thought it cowardly to flee, but Jeth had insisted, and Lana agreed they definitely needed to put some distance between her and Nero. Julian had said nothing, and hadn't since the massacre, though Rhi knew he'd been burning with rage and would be happy to kill Nero himself for his part in Vayron's death. They'd barreled through the Bezoral Quadrant, exhausted, away from Kalu. Nero, a killer with a handsome face and an ever-convincing smile, would no doubt revel in comforting a grieving galaxy. He'd need to pin the blame on Rhi for what he'd done, just like he'd blamed Allie for supposedly killing Rhi, and Siotra for killing Rhi's parents. She should have listened to Dalin.
His promises are a trap, and I thought you would do better than believe him, he'd said of Nero.
The flimsy ceasefire was merely an excuse, a cover while Nero got his hands on the tech he'd used to possess all of the royal Tassin, the guards who should have been on her side. Jeth had brought them to Elsie, a tiny moon outpost outside of Fontis, to wait out a Uniforce fleet passing through the quadrant. Rhi was practically buzzing to get back, but they were fugitives,
and they had suffered too much to fall back under Nero's control. Lana was teaching Jeth to shoot with a bow and arrow. The Uniforce never used them anymore. And, out of the corner of her eye, Rhys saw an arrow fly across the mesa. It traveled through a series of holographic bullseyes until it stuck into the bark of a tree 30 meters in the distance. Lana nodded, satisfied, as Jeth returned her bow. They moved with a serious precision, both soldiers at heart. The slaughter seemed to have brought them together, and showed Reed just how little she knew about war. She kicked up her good foot and got herself up into a handstand. After a few seconds of wobbling, she found it. That perfect equilibrium, while the tiny pebbles and tufts of grass dug into her palms. It was a way to stay calm, to keep her focus and drown out the pain of her foot. But her mind wandered to all the missteps that had led her here. All that blood. All those helpless, panicked ambassadors, overpowered and overwhelmed by the deadly Tassin. Their throats slit, blood pouring down suits and splattered across polished tables. And all the betrayals before that. The stupid, childish decisions she'd made that led to death. Abandonment. So many people hated her, and still she hated herself more. Blood was rushing to her head now, and Rhi felt herself tilt. Kicking her legs in the air, she managed to straighten out, but she could feel her arms straining. "You never could hold them that long," Julian said from behind her. The sound of his voice crashed over her. Rhi wobbled again and almost recovered, until the coin fell from her pocket. Her right elbow gave, and her body slanted too far to the left. She went crashing down in the grass. From the ground, she surveyed Julian's outline, backlit by the sun. "I still can't," she grabbed for the coin. Julian held his hand out, and she took it quickly, afraid he'd change his mind. He pulled her up, and she stood to face him now, and stifled a wince as she shifted her weight to her left foot. Outside the palace, they used to challenge each other to handstands by wading through the uneven sand that shifted underneath their palms. Was that only a few months ago? It seemed impossible so much had changed. And yet, there were moments, recently, that she felt he was coming back to her. Like when they'd taken down the robo-droid together in unison, one fluid motion. She could have sworn his eyes had told her she still meant something to him. He was still the person who knew her best in the world. He pulled the telescope out of his belt. She'd left it on the makeshift pillow of bundled-up clothes that morning. "I never thought I'd see this again. I'm sorry I gave it away. I had to barter for the fisherman's help once." "It came back to you eventually," Julian shrugged. "That it did. But the fisherman's death was a steep price to pay." "I'm sorry about your friend," he said. "It's..." Rhi paused. She was going to say, "It's okay." But they both knew it wasn't. She swallowed and changed the subject. "Fitting that," she nodded to the telescope. "You said I could borrow it till I saw you next. And here we are." Julian didn't look up. His hair would have fallen across his eyes now if he still wore it long. She wondered if he could ever look at her without thinking of his dad, the man she'd murdered over nothing. Rhi had taken so much away from this boy. Her best friend. Her ex-best friend. And in return, all she'd given him was the rage. That anger that expanded from the center of your heart and outward until you radiated it, crowding out everything else so that every happiness was poisoned and every pettiness only grew. There had been a time where Rhi could look at the world only through the lens of her own revenge. Every movement a step closer to fulfilling a bloody destiny. It had gotten her here, and any faithful followers she had were either dead or had abandoned her. None of it was worth it. She'd have to make it right. Rhi took a deep breath. "I'm sorry, Julian," she said. The words were so dumb, so insufficient, but they were the only ones that came. "I'll never stop being sorry." Julian started to make lines in the grass with the toe of his boot,
his hands shoved into his pockets. Rhee ached with the familiarity of it. He'd always done it when he was thinking, as if his brain had an excess of energy that needed to be siphoned off into multiple activities.
I know, he said at last. And finally, he looked at her, squinting against the sun. His face was thoughtful, focused, wholly absent of any hatred or scorn.
Rhee didn't think an expression so neutral could make her heart leap like it did. But maybe this was a path. He might never forgive her for killing his father, but maybe, just maybe.
Rhiannon!
Rhee turned, her thoughts interrupted. Jeth and Lana ran toward them with a furious urgency. Jeth clutched the handheld. A projection bounced in the air. Her stomach seized with dread again.
What's wrong? She asked. What happened?
Instead of answering, Jeth amped the feed so it beamed out across the tall grasses and rolling fields. On the hollow, Rhee saw her sister, her image blurry at the edges, soft and ethereal in the sunlight. She looked like an ancestor come back from the dead, because she had. A banner beneath her read, Elder Ta'an confirmed alive. Without thinking, Rhee reached out to touch her, but her fingers only met air.
Joss!
As though dispersed by her touch, the feed cut back to a news anchor.
Princess Jocelyn Ta'an has reappeared after 6 years, the anchor said,
a pretty new wave collusion who emulated Nero down to the small, polished button on the collar of his immaculate shirt.
The announcement came after a DNA test result confirmed she is the eldest Ta'an.
It panned to footage of Joss in the palace. She was beautiful, and so familiar, in every aspect the girl her sister would have become. Did become, Rhee told herself. Joss was alive, had been alive all this time.
She came,
Rhee trailed off, unable to form any kind of coherent thought, much less say a prayer. Jocelyn had come forward, answered her call, at the very moment of the greatest turmoil, when Rhee herself wasn't there. She wanted to laugh and cry at the same time. Despite knowing her sister was alive, despite having heard her voice, Rhee hadn't truly believed it until now. It was a defense mechanism, a way to protect her heart. Now she knew. This was what she had always wanted. Not just to find her sister, but to have a partner on the throne. Joss would protect her, like she always had. They could take on Nero together.
Jocelyn and the broadcaster, one of Nero's favorite shills, someone from the outer belt with flushed blue skin and yellow reptilian eyes, were talking.
Where you've been, Jocelyn?
Somewhere safe. That's all I can say. I wouldn't want to put anyone in danger, but I was cared for, and I'm thankful. Joss had poise and empathy radiating from every pore.
But didn't you say you had a bout of amnesia?
The broadcaster's pupils dilated slightly every time she asked a question.
When did your memories come back? What was your first one?
Joss's mouth opened and closed again. It was the first hint of any uncertainty. Rhee took a step forward. She was desperate to hear the answer.
It was of my father, taking my hand.
Rhee was disappointed. She wanted something specific, something about her.
When Rhiannon put out a reward for your return, you didn't come forward immediately.
Why?
Just hop on a craft and fly back through 3 war zones?
Joss said in a way that was both teasing and firm, as she lifted her chin. Rhee felt a surge of pride. That was the Joss she remembered.
I think where I've been is hardly as important as the fact I've returned now. The galaxy is suffering.
On screen, Joss blinked, pausing half a second with her eyes closed. Her lashes looked black and dramatic, and lovely against her wide cheekbones.
She's so pretty, Rhee blurted out. She was always so pretty.
She looks familiar, Jeth said.
Why wouldn't she? She's the Empress, Lana said.
Rhee felt something reach into her chest and squeeze. She used to hate that word when it was her title, yet now that it was Jocelyn's, she suddenly felt its absence.
Lana must have realized the effect of her words, because she squeezed Rhee's hand once more.
Sorry, she whispered.
That's not why, Jeth countered as he watched the hollow.
She reminds me of someone.
Me too, Julian said.
Does she not look like Rhiannon? Lana asked.
Kind of, but that's not it,
Jeth said, squinting his white eyes at the hollow. Julian cleared his throat.
Do you think we can trust her?
He asked in a low voice.
The question was so unexpected that it undercut the pleasure of hearing him say we.
What do you mean? Why shouldn't we trust her?
Rhi looked to Jeth and Lana for support, but they were both stone-faced.
Julian shrugged.
The timing is convenient, is all.
Convenient? The galaxy is at war!
But she was distracted. They were interviewing Joss in the main foyer of the palace. It looked so perfect. Or perfectly rehearsed. Staged. Now that she thought of it, everything was too perfect.
You mentioned suffering, the broadcaster said. I assume you mean the recent massacre at the United Planets gathering.
Joss nodded her head, focusing on the broadcaster.
It was a terrible, unprecedented tragedy, and I had to step forward.
To rule alongside your sister?
No.
Then Joss looked right into the camera and said,
to rule in her place.
Lana sucked in a quick breath, and Jeth paused the hollow so Joss's head was tilted to the side, her eyes, one brown, one hazel, locked on to Rhi.
No, replay it, Julian said.
I think Rhi needs a minute, Jeth said.
Replay it, Julian insisted.
When the Cherim refused, Julian grabbed the handheld out of his hand and replayed it himself. Rhi had to suffer through her own sister publicly planning to usurp her.
To rule in her place, she said once more.
Julian replayed it and replayed it.
If you're being cruel, Lana argued.
That's the girl who broke into the dojo,
Julian suddenly cried out.
She looks different, but I recognize her voice.
I thought you'd sent her, he said to Rhi, because she had your coin, or one just like it.
Rhi pulled her own coin out. Julian took it and held it up to the sun.
It was like this, but all rusted over. It's the same girl. Rhi, she intercepted a message meant for my father, which means she's either working with the Resistance
or working to destroy it, Jeth chimed in.
Guys, I've got another whammy. I think this was the girl traveling with Alyosha.
The soldier accused of my murder? The one you claimed was innocent?
Rhi asked. It seemed impossible. Her own sister circling in the same orbit of soldiers and refugees and loyalists, when Rhi herself had just discovered she was alive.
Keep playing it, all the way through, Rhi said.
I have reason to believe, as much as it pains me to say it, Joss continued,
that the Royal Tossen were conducting that attack at the command of,
she blinked here,
the younger princess, my sister, Rhiannon Ta'an. If the intelligence is correct, I am ashamed, both for myself and my family's legacy.
Jeth cursed. Rhi felt as if she had taken a blow directly to the chest. Joss had pinned the entire massacre on her.
It made sense.
That was the horrible thing. As far as she knew, no one on Kalu had any awareness of Nero's access to technology that could control the Tossen from afar. And they are, were, her royal army, after all.
She felt a flush of mortification that she hadn't seen it sooner.
How she'd been set up.
Could Joss really believe that Rhi would be capable of such a thing? Had Nero managed to convince her of it? Or was she working with him?
Joss looked directly out from the feed. She might really have been standing only a few feet away, fixing Rhi in place with her glare.
I would like to take the opportunity to tell you, Rhiannon, wherever you are, that I intend to seek justice for the victims of this terrible massacre. The person to blame must be held accountable.
Her expression could have been cut from stone. The only sign she gave of discomfort was in the way she toyed with a ring on her left hand, but her voice was profoundly calm.
Then you publicly denounce your sister?
I do, Jocelyn said. She looked directly into the camera.
Rhiannon, if you have survived, surrender now,
or never return. We must all determine to take the more difficult path, because it's the right one.
Rhee felt tears sting her eyes. She blinked. Once, twice, trying to clear her head, trying to think. Honor, bravery, loyalty.
I have another announcement to share soon that will bring much-needed hope to the galaxy, Jocelyn continued, still fiddling with the ring on her left hand, turning it over and over. And then, Rhee saw it. The sign. The clue. The message. Dalin's ring. Dalin and Jocelyn were together. It was a sign. A new spasm of desperate hope sparked inside Rhee's chest. And now she understood the hidden meaning running like a current beneath her sister's words. I intend to seek justice. The person to blame must be held accountable. And then, the last part, the very echo of Dalin's parting words. We must all determine to take the more difficult path, because it's the right one. Jocelyn and Dalin were planning to kill Nero. It was their message to Rhee. It was their invitation to her. Joss bit her lip. And there was the Joss Rhee knew and remembered. That was her sister. The one who tortured and ignored her. But the same one who'd led her out of those cellars. Who'd taught her how to cartwheel and fold tiny paper airplanes that they'd throw off the balcony. She'd come back for her. Loyalty. It was part of her Mata'an Sirili. Nero put her up to this, Rhee said to the group. She's trying to tell me so herself. She's wearing Dalin's ring. You can't be sure, Lana said. This sister of yours was confirmed traveling with the very boy who was accused of your murder, whose whereabouts are now unknown. She and Jeth shared a look. Hers was fierce, his uncertain. And she made contact with Julian. Took a valuable piece of intel meant for an important leader in the resistance. I can't be sure, Rhee agreed shakily. Her own first instinct had been suspicion. What other reason would bring Joss so close to her than the promise of the crown? They'd been interconnected all this time when Rhee was on the run for her life, and on the path to Empress. But another set of reasons seemed just as likely. That her sister was scared. That she'd been to hell and back, that reclaiming her throne was the safest bet in a world that wanted her dead. I can't be sure, Rhee repeated. But isn't that what faith is about? Finding clarity and conviction in a world that is muddied and uncertain? She thought of Dalin here, wishing he were by her side. Rhee didn't care how innocent it sounded, how foolish. Every instinct in her braided together into something resolute and sure. She knew. It was different than when she'd known Siotra was her family's murderer. So different that she hardly recognized the feeling. Trusting Joss felt like an omen. Like she'd arrived to guide her. Like Rhee might finally find her way. The feeling made her think of Dalin again. It wasn't dissimilar to how he'd described his faith. There was a silence. Rhee knew the others thought returning to Kalu now would be an act of suicide. But she couldn't let them give up. Not right now. She would need help. Protection against Nero. She needed family.
So, what do we do? Julian asked finally.
It was the same thing he'd asked when they'd gotten caught by the Tossin on Nau Fruma. It gave her another surge of hope. And her hope gave her strength. Jocelyn told me I should never return to Kalu, Rhee said. For the first time in what felt like ages, she grinned. She should have remembered that I never listen to her when she's bossing me around. Chapter 26 Kara. Kara and Allie were in a tunnel, squatting close, ready to do something big and important that would change the course of the war. But she could focus only on the nick of his eyebrow, the corner of his mouth that lifted up a little higher than the other. It felt like standing at the mouth of that tunnel was standing at the cusp of the rest of her life. Everything would change after this moment. everything already had. Then, the edges of the tunnel started dissolving around her. It was urgent, in direct relation to something she'd done.